Welcome, everyone. My name is Aaliyah Murphy, and I am the Program and Development Assistant with the National Consumer Voice for Quality Long-Term Care. We are so excited to be hosting this conference call for you today on the topic of resident-directed care. This is our third annual resident call series. We've received great feedback from residents over the past couple of years and are so pleased to be able to offer the call series again this year. I want to thank you for taking the time to be on this call with us, as we think it's a really great opportunity to bring residents together from all across the country. You're very important advocates for quality of care and quality of life, both for yourselves and for your peers, and we think that calls like these allow you to learn from one another and dialogue with one another. Now, I want to give you a little bit of background about our organization in case you're not familiar with it. We're called the Consumer Voice for short, formerly the National Citizens Coalition for Nursing Home Reform, and we are a nonprofit membership organization founded in 1975 by Elma Holder, and we advocate for quality care and quality of life for consumers in all long-term care settings, including nursing homes, assisted living facilities, home and community-based care settings, etc. This call today is part of a two-call series for nursing home residents, and support for resident participation in the conference call series is provided in partnership with Kindle affiliates, including Kindle Outreach and Kindle Corporation. On this call today, we have residents of nursing homes from all across the country, and the call is not open to ombudsmen, family members, facility staff, or others, because we really wanted to make sure it was an opportunity for residents to speak with one another openly. As mentioned, this call is being recorded and will be used for Consumer Voice purposes to develop materials for residents. A recording of the call will be available on our website, but will not include the question and answer portion. A brief overview of the call agenda is that there will be four speakers with time for question and answer at the end of the call. Your line is currently muted, and when we do open up the call for questions and comments, Andre will tell you what to do and how to register your question. Please remember that we do only have 1 hour, so that we ask that you keep your questions brief so that we can hear from as many of you as possible. We want to make sure that conference calls we host for residents are on topics of interest to you, and so this call was developed based on feedback from our advisory committee, which is made up of nursing home residents like yourself. The committee expressed that resident-directed care is imperative, and I am pleased that we were able to pull together a call today around this issue. Our speakers today are Deb Holtz, State Ombudsman from Minnesota, Mary DePasquale, President of the Ellis Manor Resident Council in Connecticut, Thomas Woods, President of the Cambridge Place Resident Council in Kentucky, and Sarah Greenberger, Coordinator of the Hartford Institute's Coalition of Geriatric Nursing Organizations in Washington, D.C. We are very happy to have them with us today, and at this time I am pleased to turn the call over to Deb Holtz, who is going to speak to us a bit about the basics of individualized quality care and the care planning process. Deb?
Thank you, Aaliyah. Good afternoon, everyone. I am so honored to be a part of this phone call, and I wish I could see all of your faces out there. I'm talking from very cold Minnesota, so I hope all of you are enjoying good weather, as we are here in Minnesota. We do like our snow. We just don't like our ice. I have been asked to talk a little bit about what is a care plan, and the basic parts of a care plan is really what works for you and what doesn't work for you. That's what it's all about. I always encourage staff in facilities, in assisted living settings, our ombudsman staff, to remember the resident. Those are the two key words. Just remember the resident, because everything is focused around you. You're part of a big team that wants to support you, but it really goes back to you. So it has to be very individualized. And when I talk about individualizing quality care and care plans, I often think of my mom and dad, who are young seniors at this point, and they really require different supports and different things in their life. For example, my dad, wherever he ends up, is going to want to wake up by 4:30 or 5 o'clock. Great for him, not for me. My mom, wherever she ends up, is going to want to wake up at probably 9 or 10, a lot later than dad. Right now they work on different things together and they adjust because they're still together. But when they end up in some kind of setting, needing some kind of support, they're going to have very different needs, and it needs to be very individualized. So, again, it's really what works for dad, what works for mom. And the plan of care should really talk about meeting their needs, meeting your needs as an individual. Sometimes there's a little bit of a tendency to look at care plans and to look at people as problems rather than looking at their needs. So I think it's really important when people are thinking about their individual needs and their individualized care plan that everything gets presented as a need or something that I want to work on instead of a problem. For example, sometimes people have some challenges with communication, especially as they grow older and may possibly have signs of dementia. And in our office, we want to make sure that we don't call those behavior problems. We call them communication needs. For example, if somebody is not understanding what's being done in the shower or bathing or cleaning, it may appear that I'm having a behavioral response to you, but really I'm communicating to you. I'm telling you that this isn't real comfortable for me. I actually had the experience this year, this past spring, of being in a nursing facility setting for an evening, for a full day. I received a new shoulder, and the operation was successful, but it overstretched a nerve, and I ended up losing the use of my arm for a couple months. So after 8 days of being in the hospital, I was sent to a rehabilitation unit. And in the nursing facility, one of the first things that didn't work real well for me was when they had to do the skin check, which is something that nursing facilities are required to do. But there's different ways that they can do it. And in my pain and in my over-medicated state with the pain meds, I was really indicating, don't do this to me now. I don't feel comfortable. It felt very invasive to me. And I know that I presented myself as probably a patient who was having a problem and a behavior and not responding to this well. But really what was happening in my thoughts and in my heart was that I was communicating to people. I was saying, don't touch me right now. Don't do this. So one of the things that we need to think about when we have individualized care for people and individualized needs is that we have to think about what works for somebody and what doesn't work. So for me, I need to have in my care plan, wherever I end up, that you need to know if I can't talk at a certain point, these are possibly actions that will communicate to you that I'm not comfortable. And a response to that would be to stop what you're doing. At that point, the skin check should have stopped because my body was saying, this is not comfortable for me, even though my voice was not actually saying it. So the plan of care is really all about you. Remember the resident. It's your blueprint. It's really what works for you and what doesn't work for you. And one of the things that's very important to remember about a plan of care is that it may involve your medical needs, it may involve your health needs, but it's really anything in your life, anything that you need. It should also address what time works best for you to get up in the morning. Are you a 5:30 morning person like my dad, or are you 11 o'clock morning person like my mom? And that's something that should be in care plans. That's very important. Everybody has a different body rhythm. Again, when I had my brief stay and they flicked the lights on very early in the morning, I think it was about 6:30 in the morning, and there was one statement, I need you to get out of bed and weigh you. That was not a great way for me to start my morning. And again, it was short term, so that makes a big difference. But long term, I would need to put into my care plan, Deb doesn't wake up at 6:30. She never did in her life before the nursing home, and she's never going to do it now in the nursing home. So that would be very important for me to have in my care plan. That's my individualized life. I'm a much, much late riser, and I go to bed late. So things like what time you want to get up. If you have a roommate who is possibly louder at certain times. That should be in your care plan in terms of what works for you. Are there times that it would be good for you to be out of the room because the roommate is doing certain things? Are there adjustments that we could make to your TV with maybe personal earplugs so that you could listen to it while the roommate is doing something else? All of that is important to have in your care plan. How often should you have a care plan? Well, the law requires that you have it every 3 months unless there's changes that are made in your health, anything that really is affecting how you're living. You should also have it 7 days after your new assessment. But I think the key to remember, for everybody to remember again, is remember the resident. So if something happens in your life and you feel it's enough of a change that we should look at what's going on in your care plan, you can request a new care plan. That doesn't mean that they will get done immediately when you request it, because part of what we're doing with this care plan, too, is to think about who's involved, who's going to be a part of it. And there are lots of wonderful people that are working to help us, to take care of things, to meet those needs. But everybody is sometimes having a lot of work. There are time pressures, there are schedule pressures, et cetera. What I always think is important for you to have at your care plan meeting, or to talk about your care planning before the meeting, is somebody that you explicitly trust, whether that is your daughter, your son-in-law, your granddaughter, a friend, a neighbor. It might be a roommate. It might be the person who lives down the hall. It might be that certified nurse's assistant who knows you inside and out. You can ask whoever you want to be at your care plan meeting. It's very important that you have somebody that you implicitly trust. Before I was an ombudsman, I'd say one of the best life experiences for me was being a mom. I have two young adult daughters who both have special needs. And so I've been to many, many planning sessions over the years. And it was always really important to me to have at least one person in that meeting that I could explicitly trust, whether that was the secretary who saw my daughter come into school every day and could call me if something happened with her wheelchair or her health care needs or her medications, or if it was that one teacher, or if it was a friend. I have one friend who has a young adult daughter who has special needs, and her goal was always to have as many people on what she called her side of the table as were on the other side of the table. So if there were 10 professionals at the table talking about her daughter, she would bring 10 of her friends, which is a little can be a little difficult to do, and I'm not suggesting that we have to do that, but that was her way of making sure that she got through the meetings. So in other words, it's just so important for care planning that you have people in your life that you trust, and it only has to be one person. It can be many, many other people, but we all know that it only takes one person to make a difference in somebody's life. So it's really important that you have somebody that you can trust. The staff that you would like to have there, you can invite. You can think about if it's a nursing assistant that really helps you. It's typically going to be a director of nursing, and many times the CNAs or the assistants or the aides will not necessarily be able to come because of their work schedules. It's still really important to get their input, to have them tell you what they think, to give them an opportunity to provide ideas for you for the care plan. So those are all very important things to think about. Your involvement is key. Whether you can be there in person, if you have health issues that limit your availability or limit your presence in meetings, you can always write down what you would like to have. You can always tell somebody. You can always request an ombudsman to be there. Every state has an ombudsman program. Every state has their own challenges with the ombudsman program in terms of not having enough people to get out there, but they will respond to your calls. If they don't, every state has a state ombudsman, like my position in Minnesota, and it's important to let those people know that your calls are not getting responded to or that you have a meeting coming up, it's important to share all of that. If you find out that care plans have been developed without your input, then it's important to tell people that too. It's just important to remind people again, remember the resident, to ask people when the next care plan is going to take place, to ask for a number for the ombudsman, to ask for the number to call again your son or daughter or granddaughter or friend, or even tell somebody in the nursing home or the assisted living setting. I think it's also really, really important for those of us like you and I who are able to articulate our needs and our ideas to listen to our neighbors, to listen to our neighbors that may live on the same floor of the nursing home but may not have as many friends or helpful people in their lives as you do. We know that there's many people out there who simply have no one in their life, and one of the ways that you and I can help them, again, with individualized quality care, is to make sure that we're listening to them, to help them have a voice, to find out where there's a resident council, to talk about it with other people, and basically just to have enormous transparency so that everybody knows what is going on, what their rights are, what the possibilities are. I pretty much over the years have learned that I think most people want to do the right things, and in when you have care planning, when you have groups and you have meetings like this, it's just really important to acknowledge what people are bringing to the table, but also help remind them who the focus is. I used to have many meetings for my daughter, and it was a challenge for me because I'm a single parent and I also had to work. So I would often request that the meetings be early in the morning or late in the afternoon to accommodate my work schedule. After I had had a couple of these meetings and I had comments from teachers that were having a difficult time making these meetings because obviously it extended their work day, I acknowledged that and I thanked them and I said, I recognize that this is a longer day for you. But I also injected a little bit of reality and humor and reminded them that it was a really long day for me too. And after the meeting, then we were going to go home and there were more cares that I needed to provide for my daughter. So it was always important for me to recognize the efforts that they were making, but also help them remember that the focus was the person that we're talking about. Remember the resident. You are the most important person here. Even though we're going to acknowledge everybody else that is a part of it and is assisting with these needs. Excuse me. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Mary or Leah, and I very much welcome questions at the end of this.
Thank you, Deb. At this time, I'm going to turn the call over to Mary DePasquale and Thomas Woods, who will be speaking a bit about resident involvement in the care planning process. Mary, if you'd like to go first.
Sure. Well, about 4 years ago, my life totally turned upside down. I went from being a night nurse at a local convalescent home to the hospital as a patient, and then to Ellis Manor in Hartford, where I'm still residing. This is in Connecticut. I got congestive heart failure, and they don't know why, probably due to a medication I was taking or sleep apnea. Then I had MRSA, a superbug, and then I had several operations on my feet and developed a surgical complication called lymphedema, which makes me big stomach, big legs, big feet. I feel and look pregnant with triplets. But I became involved in my own care plan almost immediately. I used to call my sister. She was my consultant. She's been a nurse for 36 years in a convalescent home. So because I had a wound, I was put on liquid protein, and I think people know that's the awful orange stuff. It tastes lousy and makes you sick. It makes you feel sick. I had been on a protein powder at Hartford Hospital that was mixed with applesauce. It was definitely palatable. I found out it could be purchased at a local CVS for a reasonable price, so my sister got it for me. And then I had the doctor at Ellis Manor order it and voila, no more orange stuff, thanks to just a simple phone call to a Hartford Hospital dietitian. It's important to me to get things done in a timely manner. When I could attend the resident care meetings, I wouldn't want to be surprised. You know, I go in there knowing my diagnosis, my medications, and test results, and my questions. And they've been really wonderful. I was able to take down a dose of medication. I really didn't need it. One was a sleeping pill, and I virtually eliminated it. I don't take it anymore. A hospitalist, that's a doctor in the hospital that takes care of you, not your normal doctor. He had given me a diagnosis of COPD, which is breathing difficulties, and put me on Spiriva, an inhaler. I know I didn't have it. So the next time I saw a pulmonologist for sleep apnea, I told him all this, and he tested me. There was no need to take Spiriva. There was no COPD. And this had been discussed in the care planning, too, something I was going to do. They're really a big help, but they have to know, you know, what you say. You've got to be truthful, and you've got to tell them what's going on. My resident care plan meetings are very informative. I ask questions and also inform them about changes I'd like to have made, like discontinuing medication or whatever. I attend them by myself, and I do enjoy them. When attending these meetings, don't be shy, and you have to speak up. If you have a toothache, say it. I've actually seen other patients have toothaches and say nothing. And all they need is a simple denture reline or maybe something pulled. Some don't want to bother anybody or are embarrassed. I've seen patients, and this was in my job, they start going to the bathroom day and night, but they don't say anything. And that can often be the sign of a urinary tract infection. And they say nothing until they're asked when their temperature shoots up. It's very interesting how people are. They're all different. If you're a diabetic, for example, it's good to ask during the care conference, how are your sugars running? You know, things that you should be looking for, all kinds of things, diet, exercise, medications. You've got to know what to look for like high blood sugars, low blood sugars, and it's a great place to find out. It's important to be informed and to ask questions, not to be shy and to speak out. You've got to be your own advocate. That's it.
Thank you, Mary. Thomas?
Okay.
Thomas, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, if you'd like to go ahead and speak.
Okay. My name is Thomas Woods. I'm in Lexington, Kentucky. And, excuse me, 6 years ago, I was coming home from work, and I had a car wreck. I was in a hit and run. I almost died like three times from the wreck. And, when I got to the hospital, after a month there in a semi-coma, I found out that I was paralyzed, which brought me to the nursing home I'm at now. And in my care plan meeting, I was able to change a lot of my medications because I started getting better and stronger. I just wanted people to know that it's very important that you attend all your care plan meetings because there might be something going on with you that you can change. And I'm just thankful that the nursing home I'm in listened to me and changed my problem right away. That's all I have to say about that.
Okay, thank you, Thomas.
Yes, ma'am.
At this time, I'm going to turn the call over to Sarah Berger, who will be speaking about common health issues for residents and what residents should know. Sarah?
Thanks a lot, and thank you to Deb and Mary and Tom for setting the stage so nicely, keeping the assessment and care planning process in mind. You'll want to know a bit more about some common health conditions. You asked about urinary tract infections and pressure sores. And I'm going to add a third one, restraints, because they are related subjects. So what do you need to know about a urinary tract infection, or as it's commonly called, a UTI? Most of us have had one or more UTIs, especially us poor women who are more prone to get them. Ordinarily, our urine is very clean, that is, from a bug's point of view, but our anatomy makes it easy for bugs to go right up the urethra so that the infection can occur if the conditions are just right. Even when bacteria do get into the urinary tract, infection may not occur. About half of all the residents in nursing homes have bacteria in their urine, but it doesn't cause any symptoms and doesn't need treatment. So how do you know when it does need treatment? Now we get to the hard part. Unfortunately, as we get older, the symptoms of common problems are different than in younger people. For instance, as a young person, if you had a urinary tract infection, you might have had painful, burning urination. You can't get to the bathroom fast enough, and then when you get there, not much comes out. Your urine is smelly. You might even have blood in your urine, and you might have fever. In fact, very often you have fever, and that's kind of what says to yourself, oh, got to call a doctor. But for an older person, the symptoms are usually very different, and you think, how could that be? But that's just the way we are. As older people, things are different. The first symptom is apt to be confusion, and then increased incontinence and dehydration, and by that I mean the body isn't getting enough liquids, and fever doesn't occur very often. It can, but it's not the usual symptom. So once you have some of these symptoms, confusions, incontinence, dehydration, the nurses will begin the assessment process. They will probably take a sample of your urine and send it to the laboratory to look for signs of infection, and the physician will start an antibiotic. So how can you and the staff prevent urinary tract infections or UTIs? A sure way to get a UTI, and repeatedly, is the use of a urinary catheter. Catheter is a flexible tube inserted into the body cavity to remove urine. They aren't used often because of repeated infections. People who have spinal cord injuries, like Tom, may need a catheter. Otherwise, it's the basics of healthy living that nursing assistants help you with every day that prevents you from getting a UTI. Good hygiene between your legs, feces are cleaned up immediately, and drink lots of fluids to keep your urine diluted so the bugs won't like it there. Now you're an expert on UTIs, let's turn to pressure ulcers. What is a pressure ulcer? It's an injury caused by unrelieved pressure that damages the skin and underlying tissue. Unrelieved pressure squeezes the tiny blood vessels which supply the skin with the nutrients and oxygen, and the pressure is for too long. That tissue, starved of nutrients and oxygen, dies and an ulcer forms. If we look at where they happen, you begin to understand why they're called pressure ulcers or pressure sores. A very common place to get one is right on the tailbone. Any of you who have spent a long time in bed or seated without moving, maybe even a couple of hours, may remember the backside begins to hurt. Your nerves cause the pain. So you move or someone helps you move, and that relieves the pressure. The hurt goes away. The skin, which turns red with the pressure, returns to its original color. Another way that pressure ulcers happen is by sliding down on a bed or a chair. The weight of the body pulled across the sheets or the chair seat stretches the skin. That stretched skin causes injury and an ulcer can form. So where do pressure ulcers happen? You're probably sitting in a chair or a wheelchair right now. Let's work from your toes up. If you don't move for a long time, you might see spots on the foot, the knees where they come together, the hips, the coccyx or tailbone. If you're lying in a bed or on your back or even on your side, then you might see red spots appear on the toes, heels, knees, the buttocks, elbows, shoulder, even the back of the head, and even the ears. Tubes like catheters and breathing tubes can also cause pressure on the skin that is unprotected by padding. So So who gets pressure ulcers? Anyone who is unable to move is more likely to get a pressure ulcer. The older a person is, the more likely one is to develop a pressure ulcer. You may know someone like Tom in your nursing home who had a car accident and is unable to move either from the neck down or from the waist down. Any of these residents have some problem with moving. Many people have had strokes with some paralysis. Parkinson's disease is another example of a disease that makes it hard to move. Many of us are also familiar with how arthritis can make movement difficult. Another condition that can cause a person not to move is late-stage dementia. Remember, dementia is a disease that robs a person of memory. Eventually, the ability to provide the basics of life also disappear. The injured brain no longer functions well enough for a person to walk, eat, or drink. Finally, at the end of our lives, hearts can fail, lungs can fail, but so too skin can fail. So what do pressure ulcers look like? All you need to remember is that there are different stages. The first stage being the red area that I've mentioned two or three times on the skin. And when you see it and you move yourself to a different position, then that red should disappear. If it doesn't, then you might have the start of a first stage of a pressure ulcer. The last stage may even include exposing the muscle and bones. So you see that the trajectory, or for what happens if it's not treated and most of all prevented, can lead to really grave problems. Pressure ulcers cause pain, which must be treated. They also affect our ability to take part in activities, and they make you feel very badly. A pressure ulcer means a person's daily life must change, as it takes time to care for an ulcer. Once a resident has had an ulcer, a second one is likely to happen, which is why you want to prevent them. So how do you prevent them? First thing is to inspect the skin. We had a really good example of that from Deb this morning. She told about how her skin was inspected just when she didn't like it inspected. But in spite of that, it has to be done at some point. And for those who are at risk, as I would say, more likely to get pressure sores, that's the thing, is to look at the skin every day, maybe even three times a day. And the person should be moving a lot or helped to move a lot. Drink a lot of fluids, eat really nutritious food, and keep clean from urine and feces. The skin inspection. The first step is to look at the skin every day. In nursing homes, your CNA will be checking your skin daily, so you'll want to do it together. Since you can't see your backside without using a mirror, someone will have to help you. If you have just moved and a red spot is there, wait a minute and check it again. If it disappears, then it's healthy tissue. You can probably see in your own knees, hips, elbows, and ankles, so those are good places to check on and off in any 24-hour period. Tell your caregiver if you find a red spot that doesn't disappear. That way, you and your caregiver will be each other's eyes and ears, and you can work as a team to prevent the pressure ulcers. Moving around, patients in wheelchairs who can't or do not change their positions themselves should have their positions changed every hour. That's a lot of changing, but ulcers can happen very fast. Patients who can move themselves should change positions every 15 minutes in a wheelchair. For people with especially made electric wheelchairs, this can be a fairly easy task. For others, it means lifting your bottom off the seat with your arms. This takes the load off weight off your bottom, offloading weight for short periods. This takes practice. In bed, if you can't move, someone has to help you move every 2 hours or more or less frequently, depending on the condition of your skin. You've learned about individualized care this morning, and turning schedules also need to be individualized. Getting enough to eat and drink are also important in keeping the skin healthy and moist. Let caregivers know what you like to eat and drink, and be sure those things are available. That's part of your needs and preferences being met. Keep the skin clean and dry. For those who have trouble controlling urine and feces, the best program is to meet the resident's toileting needs, taking the person to the bathroom so they aren't incontinent, or unable to take care of their urine and feces. And that is an individualized schedule that must be set up. People have a different schedule. Each one is different. And when the nursing home sets up a system of every 2 hours for toileting, and somebody doesn't toilet except for every 3 hours or every 4 hours, then they will be missed, and they will be incontinent. So it has to be individualized. For some residents, this may not be possible. Urine and feces hurt our skin, so it must be gently cleansed and dried immediately. Use gentle creams and oils, but don't use anything that dries out the skin. Protective barrier creams and excellent quality briefs that pull moisture away from the skin are used for those who can no longer use the toilet. In summary, pressure sores are preventable. Here are the steps for those who can't move themselves. Skin inspection daily, mobility, lots of liquid you like, nutritious food, and cleanliness from urine and feces. Now you're also an expert in pressure sores along with UTIs. Let's spend a few minutes talking about physical restraints because they can make it more likely you'll get a UTI or a pressure sore, and that's a good reason to avoid them. What is a restraint? It's an object or device that you yourself can't remove easily, which restricts freedom of movement and normal access to your body. Now, that's a complicated explanation, isn't it? All right, then when I talk about the examples, you'll see. Vest restraints, waist restraints, geriatric chairs, lap trays, and side rails are all examples of restraints. Think about it. If you are tied to a bed or a chair, you become completely dependent on someone else for getting to the bathroom, getting a drink, turning, or talking with people of your choice. Restraints are most often used for frail elders who fall or those with dementia who wander unsafely or someone with severe behavioral symptoms. Studies show that restraints do not protect people, but quite the opposite. They harm people. People strangle on restraints and fall over the high bed rail trying to get to the bathroom. You learned earlier today about assessment and care plan and individualized care. Avoiding physical restraints depends on exactly that process. We know from research that older people can continue to gain muscle and bone strength until the end of their life. The interdisciplinary team, including you, the CNAs, the physical therapist, nurse, will help to make appropriate plan of care to keep you moving and safe. As others have said, be your own advocate and help others get care they need.
Thank you, Sarah.